Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Associate Professor of Sociology at Charles Sturt University. Today is part of a three-part series called Masculinity Matters. Last month in the show, we explored how masculinities are made and how this can normalise power and control. This month, we shift the discussion to violence prevention. I'm joined again by Professor Michael Flood and Dr. Stephen Burrell. Their work argues that engaging men and boys in violence prevention is absolutely essential. And whilst an evidence base is growing, more work needs to be done. They call for prevention that tackles structural and cultural drivers, and they set out three principles. Violence prevention must be rooted in feminism. It must improve men and boys' lives, and it must be intersectional. The show will explain what violence prevention is, its premise, and how to approach it in regional and rural areas. Michael, violence prevention is described as having particular approaches. There's primary prevention, secondary, and tertiary. Can you explain what these are and the differences between them?
Primary prevention is aimed at stopping people from first using violence or first suffering violence. That is, it's aimed at preventing initial perpetration or initial victimization. It's successful when violence doesn't happen, when someone doesn't use violence or someone doesn't suffer violence. That overlaps with secondary prevention, which is about intervening with the people who are at risk of using violence or at risk of suffering violence. And then tertiary prevention, or intervention it's sometimes called, is about working with the victim survivors of violence and also working with the perpetrators of violence to hold them accountable, and then longer term responses to support victim survivors and again to encourage non-violence among perpetrators. So if we go back to primary prevention, that's about stopping violence in the first place, stopping violence before it starts. And what it tries to do is change the social conditions that feed into domestic, family, and sexual violence. It's trying to change the social norms, the sets of social expectations that feed into some people's use of violence or tolerance of violence. It's trying to change the everyday practices that can be violent or feed into violence. For example, young men assuming that if a girl has had sex with them before, that she's necessarily consenting to sex again, or assuming that because she's consented to one sexual practice, she's consented to every sexual practice, and so on. So it's about changing norms, about changing practices, and about changing structures, changing the patterns of social inequality or social disadvantage and so on that feed into violence.
And all of this is based on a very important premise, isn't it? Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Primary prevention is based on a profound insight that perpetrators are made, not born. Boys, don't come into the world as little babies wanting to pressure a wife or girlfriend into sex, or wanting to insult or control or abuse their partners, or indeed, to attack other men. Instead, perpetration is a social product. It's shaped by socialization, by social conditions. So perpetrators are made, not born. So we have to change the social conditions and settings that produce them. So when it comes to how we do that, one of the most common ways that primary prevention works is through programs in schools, working with children and young people in schools to encourage healthy, respectful relationships. So building attitudes of respect and equality in their relationships, teaching young people how to negotiate consent, how to manage conflicts peacefully, and so on. But that's probably one of the most common strategies of prevention there is, but there are many others. Social marketing and communication strategies are aimed at shifting community attitudes or social norms. Community mobilization strategies are aimed at mobilizing women or men or others as advocates and actors in their communities to take leadership, to be good role models in their families, or to raise issues of violence and prevention in sports or in their faith setting or church or in their workplace and so on. So violence prevention can involve face-to-face education. It can involve social marketing and communication. It can involve community mobilization. It can involve addressing other social problems that feed into violence, such as alcohol and drug abuse, such as the availability of violent pornography, such as the availability of guns, such as mental health issues, and so on. And certainly some of violence prevention is about trying to build healthier, more equitable models of how to be a man. So it's work with men and boys to encourage what some people call positive or healthy masculinities. But that's only one of the strategies we can use. And the last strategy I'll mention is law and policy. Law and policy are crucial tools of prevention. They can, for example, address the economic inequalities that make some women vulnerable to domestic violence. If women are dependent on their male partners, if they don't have access to resources of their own, if they're much more likely to face poverty, if they leave a male partner, they will be more vulnerable to domestic violence than the women who have access to work, to money, to some kind of economic autonomy. So the law can address that. The law can also address pornography, gun use, social media platforms, and the way that they can encourage misogyny and sexism and so on. So violence prevention includes a whole range of potential strategies. What actually has been practiced in Australia is a much more limited subset of those. But primary prevention in general, as I've said, is trying to change the social conditions that feed into domestic, family and sexual violence.
And that doesn't just sound structural, that sounds cultural as well, like tapping into and changing cultural norms.
Absolutely. Look, understood properly, primary prevention is a project of culture change. It's about changing the elements of our society or our culture that enable perpetration, enable the use of violence, and that enable victimisation, that is suffering violence.
Yeah, can I just jump in there? I think that's something which people don't often grasp about primary prevention, is that it's about building gender equality ultimately, you know, and other forms of social equality as well. Because, for example, like the gender pay gap, right? People might not immediately think that's related to violence against women. But ultimately, if we continue as a society to pay women less than men, we're essentially saying, you know, that women, the work that women do, that women's lives are just worth less, right? And so if we're then teaching boys and girls from a young age that femininity, that women, that we're just valuing them less in society, then that's kind of, it's embedding this idea, right? That I suppose that can then embed the idea that men are better than women, that men are therefore entitled to certain things from women, to treat women how they want, that, yeah, men are somehow superior. And that is at the foundation, I guess, of men's violence.
So how do you actually get men and boys involved? How do you engage them? That seems like the hard part. Like creating a program seems like the easy part, but how do you get them to show up and stay involved, come around? What does that look like in practice? And how do you bring them in and keep them going, especially when it's difficult?
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult, you know. Like, I think that is often the first key challenge, is getting men through the door, getting them involved in these conversations. Because as I said before, it's uncomfortable, isn't it? And these are issues which are often portrayed as being women's issues, you know, which are somehow unrelated to us as men. But of course, they affect all of us. I'm sure pretty much all men will know a woman in his life, whether he actually is aware of it or not, who has experienced, some form of violence or abuse at the hands of men. Because, of course, as well, if we think about things like street harassment here as well, right, that is such a commonplace experience. You know, almost all women will have experienced that at some point or another in their lives. There are so many reasons why, I guess, this is something men should care about. I mean, if we want to live in a society which is equal and just and fair, which I think, you know, we all ultimately do, then this is something we should all be invested in. But yeah, I guess to show care and to engage with this issue, that can involve actually resisting some of these gender norms that we've been talking about, right? Because it isn't seen as very manly to show an active interest and care and concern for what's going on in women's lives. Actually, speaking out about, you know, violence that men are doing towards women, whether that's personally in your own life or at a more social level, you might be mocked for that. You might be bullied for that. You might be seen as being gay or being weird, or, you know, why are you concerned about that? So it can require courageousness, I suppose, from boys and men to speak out about this. But But in terms of what we can do, what governments can do, what organizations like schools, workplaces can do, I think for me it's about finding different ways of trying to start a dialogue, you know, that this isn't about lecturing boys and men, just telling them how to behave, what not to do, because yeah, it's unlikely that that's going to have a long-term impact. I guess it's more about starting a conversation.
So, if you were coming out here to rural New South Wales, to the Central West, where we have some quite extreme masculine cultures like Bathurst race culture, we have very masculine industries, higher levels of racism, and being a man is quite narrowly defined in rural and regional areas. So, you're getting a lot of boys with strong hyper-masculinity messages. How would you design a violence prevention program out here? And how would it differ from a city program?
I did some work in Victoria a couple of years back in a rural context, and so I've thought about this. And look, I think in many ways, I think I at least would do very much many of the same things that I would do in a city context. That is, I would, you know, if I was trying to appeal in particular to the men in the room, on the one hand, I would use a values case, a case about, you know, we care about women and girls. You know, we've all got women and girls in our lives that we deeply care about. We don't want them to be harmed. We don't want them to suffer abuse in the relationships. An appeal to notions of fairness and, you know, dignity and care and so on. So I think part of the appeal is a kind of values case, which we can personalize, but we can also put in terms of values, because certainly most men, like most people in the community, have some kind of sense of, you know, fairness or equality as decent values. I would also appeal to personal benefit, the way that men ourselves will benefit from progress towards ending domestic and sexual violence. Benefits in terms of improvements in the lives of the women and girls around us, improvements in what is a very significant and expensive social problem, improvements in how men are seen, and you know, a lowering of the kind of distrust and suspicion that men are sometimes treated with, understandably, because of the violence that some men use. So I think some of the same appeals would be the same. I would acknowledge, as I tend to, that yes, men too are the victims of violence, including violence against men by women. I would acknowledge women's violence against men. I would speak squarely to some of the kind of common myths and forms of resistance or pushback that are common among male audiences or mixed gender audiences. So I think I'd do many of the same things. I probably would work a bit harder to respond in compassionate and constructive ways to traditional gender roles, because there's certainly some anecdotal evidence that they're stronger in the bush than in the city. One of the key things I would do, however, is I would try to find out what stories or histories or values there might be in that context that I could use to in the name of violence prevention. Is there, you know, are there any particular, you know, local leaders or community heroes that I could call on as positive role models? Are there histories that could support the kind of values case that we're making here? Are there, you know, is there a sense of community spirit or looking out for your neighbor or, you know, some other kind of local or cultural set of values that I could draw on? Because in any context, rich or poor, black or white, you know, straight or gay, in any context, in any community, there will be specific risk factors that feed into domestic and sexual violence on the one hand, and there will be protective factors on the other, factors that make that violence less likely. And in a rural context, there may be some things we can draw on that we can mobilize. We might have to reframe them slightly, notions of looking out for your neighbor, or there might be positive resources in that community that we could draw on. So in short, there'd be many things I would do in your context that would be similar, and some things that might be somewhat different.
And I think something which is a bit of a truism as well across contexts is that what Michael mentioned before about community mobilization, right? And I guess ideally with prevention, where I think this should be something which is coming out of communities themselves. And it's like, how can funders help to support that, for example, you know, rather than kind of helicoptering in from the outside and telling communities how to do things? Like, ideally, if this is coming organically, you know, from within communities, and how can we support that? So it's people from that same community talking to each other, I think that's going to have the biggest impact, really.
And what about the efficacy of the programs? We do hear some criticism of them. Some people say they don't work.
Look, I'll speak to that. I'm frustrated to hear simplistic versions of that criticism, because there is a wealth of research that well-designed violence prevention programs can have positive impacts. There are literally hundreds of evaluations, for example, of face-to-face education programs in schools, and they show that well-designed programs, that is, multi-session, interactive, participatory programs, lower levels of support or tolerance for violence and can lower actual levels of violence, victimization, and perpetration. Likewise, there's evidence that community-based programs built on community development and community mobilization can lower levels of violence at a community level. There's even evidence at a national level that putting funding and supportive laws into place can lower levels of violence at the national level over the long term. So if people say that violence prevention doesn't work, they're simply ignorant or dishonest. Having said that, people point to Australia and people point to the high rates of intimate partner homicide we've seen in Australia. Now, in Australia, over the last 2 decades, rates of intimate partner homicide have gone down, rates of physical assault against women have gone down, and community attitudes towards domestic and sexual violence have improved. In other words, there is a pattern of long-term improvement in this issue in Australia, and that's a reflection of violence prevention. However, rates of sexual violence have stayed roughly the same, and rates of intimate partner homicide, while they've declined over the last 2 decades, they did spike over the last 2 years when we saw a kind of unusual or a change in that pattern where rates of intimate partner homicide went up. And people might say, oh, that tells us that violence prevention doesn't work. I would say instead, no, it tells us that we've not done enough. Because while we have a very good framework for violence prevention in Change the Story, the national framework developed by the violence prevention organisation Our Watch, only a small portion of the strategies and initiatives recommended in that framework have actually been implemented by governments. So I think the problem is not that violence prevention doesn't work. I think the problem is that violence prevention hasn't been tried. That is, it's not been tried very much. And we need the funding and political will to really implement violence prevention at a comprehensive level before, we could make any claim about its ineffectiveness.
I would totally agree with that. And I think people often seem to think you can just do prevention on the cheap, that you can come in, have a one-off workshop, or even in the case of certain universities, perhaps, you can have an online module about gender-based violence, and that's enough, and that somehow that's going to transform these deeply embedded social issues. And clearly it's not enough. And if we're taking prevention, if we're taking these issues seriously, we need to invest much more in a long-term, ongoing, multi-level systemic change of the kind Michael's talking about. But if we do that, prevention can absolutely make a huge difference to people's lives.
It does seem extraordinary how community perceptions have changed in quite a short period of time. I remember when people would always say, why doesn't she leave? That women shouldn't wear short dresses and go out. And that seems like not very long ago, and people don't tend to say that as commonly anymore.
Look, there's
So,
still some victim blaming. I think people in the community still have fairly poor understandings of what might make it very hard for a woman to leave a relationship where she's suffering violence or abuse. And there is still victim blaming, I'm sorry to say, but I also agree with you that community attitudes have also improved in significant ways. For example, community recognition of the range of physical and non-physical behaviours that are part of domestic violence has increased. And community support for consent, for the idea that you should make sure that you're not pressuring or coercing the person you're with into sex, that's increased. So there's progress, but there's some areas where there's not been much progress.
I teach sociology, and a large part of that is about gender. And I find there's a lot of awareness with the young women, but not so much with the young men all of the time. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that I would say that just kind of underlines the points we're trying to make here, really, that we need to be engaging a lot more with men and boys, right? And that is ch a challenge. And that's exactly why we need to be investing a lot in prevention work, so we can really have these conversations, not in a kind of superficial or a tokenistic way, but in an in-depth, ongoing way where we're making the links across multiple different issues, not just violence against women, but also violence against men and men's health issues and women's health issues and LGBTQ rights. These issues are all very much interlinked, and they link to wider social inequalities as well. And I do think that, of course, we have a particular issue. You know, I feel we're living in a time of crisis, really, aren't we? We have multiple overlapping crises going on. Like, there's an ongoing cost of living. You know, many people are really struggling economically since COVID. We've got wars going on, horrific wars, climate change, and so on and so forth. Lots of us are facing a great deal of anxiety and uncertainty. And I think we have to acknowledge as well that in that context, that can lead to people feeling more unwilling to embrace change, or feeling more threatened, or sense of grievance. And we have seen the rise of the kind of manosphere and how that's expressed in quite mainstream politics. I mentioned already Donald Trump as the most obvious example, but we see that in many different contexts as well. And I think that's something we have to be cognizant of, is how do we deal with that kind of backlash when we're doing this kind of prevention work, when we're having conversations with boys and men, because some people are trying to blame women and blame feminism for all the problems that men and boys have, which is actually just leaving men more isolated, more alienated. It's exacerbating their problems, because, you know, the only way we can address any of this is by working together, all of us, and connecting with women, with other people in our lives, and actually building relationships with each other. I think that's the only way we can solve these problems.
Right. That does seem like a very positive entry point. And what Michael was saying earlier about acknowledging women's violence against men, acknowledging men's violence against men, acknowledging that not all men are violent, I find those to be really helpful entry points to those conversations with young people. So thanks for that. And now I have a final question for you both, and that's about men who want to get involved in stopping violence but don't know where to start. What would you say to these men who want to be part of change but feel unsure, maybe defensive, when these issues are raised?
Can I leap in, Stephen, and then you can follow up?
Please. Look,
the first thing I'll say, because I do get men coming up after talks and workshops and asking precisely that, and there are a lot of men out there who want to make some difference. The first thing I would say, frankly, is start with yourself. Put your own house in order. That is, I think, a key part of this work has to be for us to look at our own lives and our own relations and really honestly try to ask ourselves, am I consistently treating the women and girls in my lives, and indeed the men and boys, with respect and care? And that can be a hard question to ask. Having said that, the aim is not perfection. The aim is not to be some kind of perfect man who's never set a foot wrong. The aim is to raise the bar. The aim is to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And so the first thing we can do is try to put our own houses in order. The second thing we can do is just speak up in our everyday lives. Speak up when, you know, your uncle makes a sleazy joke about women or the Christmas dinner, or speak up when you realize that your brother-in-law is constantly texting his wife and hassling her about having friends or what she wears and so on. In other words, speak up when we see the comments, the jokes, the behaviors that are part of domestic and sexual violence. So that's the second thing. Take action amongst, you know, in our everyday lives. The third thing we can do is join campaigns and efforts. Join the collective efforts to end domestic and sexual violence. Contact the local domestic violence centre or Red Crisis Centre and ask, what can I do as a volunteer? How can I help? You know, join campaigns like the White Ribbon Campaign and other violence prevention campaigns. There's some of what we can do, and certainly we shouldn't assume that we have to have absolutely perfect lives to, you know, take action. We shouldn't assume we can go it alone, like, you know, John Wayne or some kind of heroic male figure. We need friends and connections to do this work. And third, I think we need a positive vision of the community, the society that we're trying to contribute to, and that can be sustaining, particularly as part of a community of support. Stephen, what else?
Well, I mean, the only thing I would add to that is just, you know, thinking about my own life as well and how my own journey. And I would totally agree with Michael, like, you know, none of us are perfect. You know, we're all learning constantly. We're all making mistakes. The key thing is to be willing to acknowledge that, right, and be willing to learn from that. And I guess connecting to that, yeah, the thing that I think of is, in just in addition to what Michael said, is it's just listening to women, right? Like, listening to women in our lives, learning from them about their experience of the world, which might be quite different to ours in ways we might not have even realized or thought about. But also on a more social level, you know, reading feminist texts or podcasts, or, you know, reading books by women and films and so on and so forth. Just learning what life is like for women in society today. And I think that's not just going to help us to understand issues like gender-based violence and the role we can play in addressing it, but also just understand better how society works in different ways for different people, and actually, yeah, how the inequalities which exist in society are causing huge problems for all of us, and how it benefits all of us in the end to work to change them, including us men. And actually, I think by embracing that kind of struggle together with one another, we will find our own lives incredibly enriched. And that's certainly been the case for me, you know, that gradual ongoing attempt to figure out how I've been affected by these norms and expectations about masculinity, and trying to unpick that and move away from that, I've found incredibly enriching. And I think that would be the case for other men as well.
Well, that's a great positive note to wrap up on. Thanks, Stephen. And thank you both for bringing your knowledge and your wisdom out to the Central West. I really appreciate having you on the show, and it's also been really lovely to meet you both.
Thank you again for your time, Donna. Great to share a space with you, Stephen.
And, you too. Thank you. And yeah, thanks so much, Donna. It's lovely to meet you.
I'm now joined by my colleague, Sonia Maria. So, Sonia, very interesting interview. And so what really struck me was that both of our guests talked about how we can talk to men when they very much feel defensive about the problem of domestic violence. What did you think about that?
Donna, it made me reflect on some recent conversations I've had with work colleagues. And I was recalling an event that had happened recently where one of my colleagues at work had turned to me. We were talking about women's stuff in general, and he was saying how he had felt very picked on recently and personally felt quite defensive about, you know, he felt he was the typical bloke that everyone, you know, thought was all wrong. You know, he was an older man, white, you know, mid-50s kind of thing, and he felt like he was the stereotype. And as a result, he was quite defensive. And when we were, you know, talking in general about things, I had to reassure him that it wasn't him, that he had of the attitude that, it, you know, it's not all men and et cetera, et cetera. And I felt I had to be reassuring to him to try and get him to understand where the issues were coming from. And I wanted him to step up and admit that there was a problem, because it still felt like he was in a bit of denial about it by doing this whole I feel defensive, I feel attacked, instead of kind of acknowledging that there was an actual problem. So after listening to these interviews, I feel like I have a bit of a toolkit now, a bit of a few new skills, which I think has been really good for me.
Well, firstly, it's not women's job to manage men's defensiveness. And it is a bit of diversionary behaviour. We're trying to talk about domestic violence, sexual violence, and they want to talk about how they are upset by this, when really the conversation is about a pattern of behaviour where men are largely the perpetrators of violence in domestic and family situations. And if we could learn ways to keep the conversation on that trajectory and not on the trajectory of, hey, you're a woman, you should make me feel better about myself if I feel uncomfortable, then that would be a really good way to progress. And I think what I heard both of our guests saying is that there are ways to do that. For instance, starting with a conversation about, like, you're right, it's not all men, but let's talk about the problem. It's not personal and we're talking about patterns. The other thing is to start with values. Like, we have shared values. We want our communities, we want children in those communities to be safe. So what can we do? And maybe this is something that we can talk about with our next guest as well, Sonia. Next month, we will be talking to Dr. Jasmine McDonald, who's a research fellow in the Child Family Community Australia Information Exchange at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. So we're going to talk to Jasmine, particularly around coercive control.
That sounds really good, Donna. Look forward to it.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by The Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google The Gender Network at Charles Sturt.